and put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Good morning. This is the Resiliency Radio Hour. We are streaming from the Graysale Studios in Westerly. This is WBLQ FM 103.1, stereo 1230, and streaming worldwide on WBLQ.net. I am the alternate host for Resiliency Radio Hour. Our beloved normal host is out of the office this week. So I'm Renee Stoops with the Southern Rhode Island Conservation District. And we have today our regular guests, the Westerly Land Trust, with Mark Doherty and Erica Liebling. And I will let them introduce their special guest today.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Renee. And I would call you, you're 1B. You're not number two. You're 1B host.
1B,
so,
okay.
Yeah, glad you're here, and thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, so today we brought along our friend Shannon Kingsley, who is part of the Reseeding Rhode Island Initiative, which is part of the Rhode Island Wild Plant Society. Shannon and I met last year. She contacted the Westerly Land Trust and told us a little bit about their reseeding initiative, collecting native wild seeds to increase the genetic diversity in that plant population. So welcome, Shannon. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about the Rhode Island Wild Plant Society, and then a little bit more about what you do?
Yeah, sure. So the Rhode Island Wild Plant Society, we affectionately call it RIPS, is a nonprofit based in Rhode Island that works to promote the planting of native plant species around the state. They lead botany walks, they do educational programs, and they're also in charge of the big native plant sales every year.
We're excited about those native plant sales, actually.
Yeah.
We're planting a little bit of a pollinator garden at Barlow Nature Preserve, which is the Land Trust headquarters, and we definitely hope to scoop up whatever we can find there. So
yeah, well, you better come early because they run out fast, but they're a popular
when is
event. I can get you the dates for that,
June 3 is maybe one. I just put them on my calendar the other day. But I think with the with them selling out, I think that talks about the need for more people growing native plants, more distributors growing native plants. I think that's part of y'all's mission, right?
Yeah. So the Reseeding Rhode Island project is based largely on the Ecotype Project, mm-hmm. which was founded by Sephra Alexandra and Dina Brewster, and that's based in Connecticut. And so with that project, they were collecting wild native ecotypic seeds and then growing them out at farm sites in Connecticut and then collecting that seed. And so those seeds are actually being sold through a for-profit organization called Eco59. If anyone listening is looking for native ecotypic seeds to grow in their gardens, they can go to eco59.com to buy those seeds. They're a great organization. Modeled our project after the Ecotype Project. And so it kind of became something of interest within the RIPS organization because people involved in the plant sales were looking to have an ecotypic seed source for those plant sales. So right now, the plants that RIPS grows for their plant sales are native and generally really great for pollinators and such, but they're not necessarily ecotypic plants, meaning that those seeds, that lineage of seed wasn't from a population sourced from Rhode Island. So the idea with Reseeding Rhode Island is that we will have a seed source that is based in Rhode Island.
So Shannon, I have to ask, how far back in time do you go to define what that ecotype is?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for the most part, we collect from populations that are, that so as far as we can tell, are quote, truly wild. So when I am looking for populations of the species that we're looking for, I talk with land trust stewards, like such as Mark, to find out, like, if that land was ever ceded, restored, like some land history, like was it farmed, was it used for anything specifically? And so if the answers to those questions are like, no, it was never ceded, restored, like, no, it's not past farmland within the, like, you know, I guess like within the last like 100 years, you know, it's a little tricky. Like, we do it to the best of our ability. But yeah, so if anything was ceded or restored, we don't collect there because the idea is that those seeds might have originated from, like, you know, the Midwest or somewhere out of, you know, our ecotype region.
I bet in old farm sites, like, is that like grass seeds? Are you collecting grasses too?
We are. We have we collected about, I think, 5 grass species. So of course, like, you know, for most of our species, they're great pollinator species. So that's another part of our mission with our project is to, like, increase the number of native pollinators in the state. And on farm sites, but we are collecting some grass species because, you know, like, grasses are awesome for soil stability. They help with overwintering insects, food for birds and wildlife, etc.
So do we actually have truly wild lands that you've identified in Rhode Island?
So, yeah.
Kind of
so
astonishing, really.
So, yeah. So, of course, like, a lot of Rhode Island is, you know, developed and...
Or has been.
Or has been, right. Right. So again, so like we do it to the best of our ability. And so like places like Grills Preserve where I've collected some seed, you know, Mark has, you know, determined that those seeds of the species that we're looking for, there's no record, I guess, within Westerly Land Trust that those seeds were seeded. But yeah, so like truly wild again, it's like there's a lot of gray area in it.
Sure, sure. Well, that's great. I walk at Grills a lot, so.
and the biodiversity there is kind of the hallmark, which is surprising because, I mean, Grills does have a deep human history and some of it not so bright. You know, it was the home of the Bradford Dye Association. There was definitely there's soil and water pollution there, but to see that the environment is resilient with some help. With some stewarding,
with
is
own
pretty important.
Seed bank.
Yeah, absolutely. Resurging. You know, there's pictures. I don't know a gem of a spot at Grills Preserve. If anyone has been, is we call it Big Hill. It's, you know, not that big of a hill, but I think it has some of the best views around. I found, and I seen pictures going back. I think to the 20s, and it was completely grassland. There were a few pasture white oaks there, but just to think in that 100 years how much that landscape has changed is remarkable. So to know that seed bank was there the whole time, waiting to and you know at forest edges to encroach in as well is cool.
And just to clarify for listeners, so there's three parking, you know, entry points for Grills Preserve, and I know not all of them are Westerly Land Trust, so let's just clarify that because the other two, I believe, are Hopkins.
Yeah, and another great thing about Grills Preserve, too, so the Westerly Land Trust manages a little over 500 acres on the westerly side of the Pawcatuck River, but our neighbors, the Hopkinton Land Trust, on the other side of the river, manage just about the same, and they have two entrances off of Chase Hill Road and
Right across from Patsy's.
Yes.
And then right off of 91.
Yes, yes.
So Rhode Island of you. To directions.
Yeah.
So, hey, I mean, I go to Patsy's a lot too.
It's the time of the year, you know?
Yes.
So I think that's great. That's that, and the partnership between the two organizations historically to build the Polycoon Bridge, which allowed you to cross the river. I mean, it's an amazing story. It's an amazing, and I think it's that contiguous habitat is not only valuable for wildlife, but it's valuable for recreation too. I think to have over 1,000 acres of trails in a densely populated place like Rhode Island is amazing.
Yeah. And so the Westerly Land Trust site is down Bowling Lane.
Yes, at the end of Bowling Lane. Yeah. Yep. Nice big parking lot there. So
and a composting toilet.
I was just about to say, a compostable
Where else can you go to a trailhead and find a composting toilet?
Yeah.
It's incredible. Whatever. Why did you guys end up doing that? That's kind of unique.
Yeah, I can speak to that, Renee. So one thing that kind of sets us apart from a lot of other land trusts is that we have a really in-depth education program. And one thing that the education program requires is that if field trips are going to attend any of our properties, there needs to be a bathroom on site for students. So that toilet was built, installed, whatever you want to call it, a little bit of both, I guess, with funds thanks to the
Southern New England.
Thank you. I need a running
educational
start.
Finish it.
It's snack.
It's just snack.
Yes, I know, and that's what I always refer to it as.
Yeah.
So, we are very, very thankful to them for seeing that as an opportunity to bring to basically unlock those 500 acres kids weren't able to really to investigate and explore, and that was a great opportunity.
And actually, that brings us back to Shannon, because the day that we met, so I think You can interject here too, Shannon. My role as a land steward, I'm not capable of, the Westerly Land Trust isn't capable of doing the work that some of the organizations like the Wild Plant Society is able to do. So, it's on us to facilitate people like Shannon. So Shannon reached out to us looking for permission to collect wild seeds, because I think there's a little bit of a conversation to be had about the ethics of collecting anything from nature, whether you're foraging for food or collecting wild seeds. There's a fine balance here. So Shannon reached out to the Westerly Land Trust for permission to collect seeds. And I said, sure. And why don't we go for a walk together, and I'll introduce you to a little bit of the habitat so you can go out and botanize and you can find what you're looking for. Hopefully I can help. So we went, and as usually happens at Grills, it went about probably an hour longer than I was anticipating. And I was going to support some of our other coworkers who were welcoming students from the Westerly Public Schools there. And we had to race to the parking lot, and I thought I was going to miss the bus. And I had flashbacks to childhood, but I didn't miss the bus, and everything was good.
Yeah,
we were having too much fun, I think.
I think we ended up running the last quarter mile.
I hope I didn't make you run, but yeah, maybe you just felt compelled. You're like, yeah. Why is this guy running? You know.
We also, I think you tried to catch a snake.
Oh, yes.
So while we were walking too.
yeah, that black racer.
So that, yeah.
Oh, okay, so we can talk about snakes too. Grills has a lot of snakes, a lot of black racers, especially.
A lot of wetland habitat.
A lot of
over
wetland.
There.
Yes, yeah. A ton. So we were in the northwest, or I'm sorry, the southwest section of the preserve, which is far away, and we heard a rattling in the leaves, and it was a black racer, and so it was kind of alerting us that it was there. They're really fast snakes, skinny, long black snakes with white under their chin, and they actually do that behavior it mimics a rattlesnake almost. It's a sort of an alarm in a similar way to a rattler's rattle would be. So if you are out in the woods and you hear,
or if
this
you have
sound,
ducks and they lay eggs,
yes.
Because I had to be Steve Irwin and get one of those FCC violations out of there.
So you knew that there was a snake there because
I knew there was a snake there because I saw a big snake eating my eggs.
Oh boy.
And I was Steve Irwin for a day.
Uh-huh. And you got your snake.
It was the first
out.
Time I ever touched a snake.
Wow.
And I was terrified.
And they're not slimy at all. I don't know why sometimes people think
No,
that.
But they're strong.
They are strong
and they will manipulate their muscles to get out of your hands. So my pro tip, because I've done it now, is I was pretty confident because it had an egg in its mouth, and I know that snakes can't bite you if they have something in their mouth, and it's also very hard for them to spit anything out or swallow very quickly. So it had an egg in its mouth, and that's why I touched it. The second time I had to do it, it dropped the egg, and I was like, oh! Grab right by the head, right?
Yep.
Tightly.
Yep,
you're not
right
going to hurt them.
Slide up.
Yep. And do whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't kill a snake just because it's outside. That's where they live.
Yeah.
So, I put it in a bag, though. A laundry bag. I felt like I was a professional with a snake bag.
That is.
And I put him in there. He got the egg, so I gave him a little snack, too, and I drove him down the street.
So you know,
I'm a jerk.
We'll segue that into Steve Irwin, and I would just like to give a shout out to him and all. What would you call them? Media naturalists, Jeff Korn. These people had a huge influence on my life and propelled me to where I am now. And I'm so thankful for that. So if there's and I love to see nowadays too, with like TikTok and Instagram, there's people finding a voice and outlet. And I see people that were clearly inspired by Steve Irwin doing these bits now. It's great to see that continue. I think it's really important. Wildlife inspire people. We can dive closer. We can get more involved in general ecology and plants. But there's an interesting power behind these unique animals that really bring people and introduce them to the wonders of nature. So
wild plants, wild animals. I mean, they go together. That's mm-hmm. kind of the point of a lot of the wild plant ecotypes, and the reason for focusing on them is because they've, you know, evolved relationships with a lot of our wild, whether it's pollinators or birds mm-hmm. or mammals, you know.
And there's a wonder. Yeah, there's a wonder in the wild. There's a difference that we feel, you know.
Yeah.
In something that's been there. So, Shannon, do you want to, we'll go back to talking about native seed collection and talk a little bit maybe about the ethics and how you go about collecting wild seed.
Ethics is a big topic. But we follow the Seeds of Success protocol, which was outlined by the Bureau of Land Management. And so we use their protocols as guidelines for collecting. So basically what Seeds of Success or SOS protocols lays out is that, you know, you can only collect from a population that has 50 or more individuals. You can only collect from a population that is healthy and self-sustaining. So meaning that, you know, even if we collect some seed, that population will be able to disperse enough seed back into the wild to sustain itself for the next season. And a
population is one species in a certain region, right? Or
yes,
a certain area,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and like in a certain region, yeah. Uh-huh.
So you come across a field and there's a bunch of gray goldenrod in the field. But there's another field a mile away with gray goldenrod too. Those are two separate populations, right?
Yeah, I would consider those two separate populations for like the purposes of our collections. But yeah, and so also we collect from the same population multiple times during its seeding period, which goes both ways. So it helps us because we then collect more genetic diversity. Or we're hoping we're collecting more genetic diversity because we're not collecting like all the seeds in one go. So a plant generally will, its seeds will develop at different rates so that we might go, you know, August 1st to collect some seed and then we'll go back on August 15th. And so a little bit more seed will have developed and then maybe we'll go back, you know, a month later, September 15th, and then we'll collect a little bit more seed. So the idea behind that is that we're not taking all of the seed from the plant, like, in one go, but we're also collecting at different stages to get that genetic diversity. Another thing I like to do is, like, make sure that the populations that we're collecting from aren't being necessarily collected by that land trust or by that organization that, you know, that's stewarding that property because I don't want to like over collect, right? So like I might be following these SOS protocols thinking, okay, yep, like we've got more than 50 individuals, I'm not taking more than 10% of the seed in one go, I'm going multiple times during the season. But then if another researcher is out there doing the same thing and then another researcher, then we're like gonna deplete that population. So I like to make sure that the places where I'm collecting have pretty minimal collection from the populations that I'm looking at.
Yeah, that's great to think about, you know. And I think that leads us into a sort of a tragedy of the commons conversation because foraging and collecting of wild seeds is I like to think that people are becoming more aware of it and I think that is really great. But we need to realize that and the places that might seem wild to the individual when you come and visit you know, there might have been somebody there the day before you doing the same thing, or these marginal impacts. You know, your dog's pooping on the trail and you're not picking it up. Okay, yes, we can talk about it being an inconvenience for people stepping on poop. You say, oh well, it's natural. But think about everybody's dog is pooping there over time, and that's where we can really scale things up to become a threat to our natural resources.
I was gonna say, isn't like dog poop is not compostable because of the food they eat in the ash? What?
Yeah, something's I've heard that in as well. That, they're like, eating a processed diet, yeah. So it's not like animal poop, and it's not the same way.
It's like it's animal not, poop, but.
Yeah, well,
no, I get it.
Yeah, so for example, something that comes up a lot is like horse poop on trails. Horses are ruminants. Are they ruminants? They eat grass, and so their poop actually breaks down a lot quicker than other animals than a dog feces would.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that we need to, when we are foraging for mushrooms or you know, going out into our backyard and collecting seeds, the woods behind our house and collecting seeds, we have to just be aware that other people are using this land too.
Yeah, and then another point about like ethics and such, we only collect like common species, so we don't touch anything, of course, like endangered, rare, et cetera, you know, so that, you know, if we are collecting these seeds, you know, the likelihood that these species are occurring widely over the state, you mm-hmm. know, is likely.
Well, the hope is that the whole point of collecting these seeds is to then take them and propagate them and transplant them and expand the wild populations to other possibly less wild places. But I'm curious, you know, how well that works. Like if you collect wild seeds, even the wild ecotype seeds, but then you transplant them to a much more managed piece of land, you know, whether it's a homeowner's backyard, whether it's, you know, a farm that's being managed for multiple purposes, you know, and how well the transplanting works when you're taking it out of that truly native environment and putting it to something not native.
Yeah, and I'm in charge of seed collecting, not as much of the propagation. Like, that's not my, you know, expertise. But we are working with horticulturist Barbara Shaughnessy, and so she has a lot of experience caring for these native seeds and native seedlings. My understanding is that growing native species from wild seed is like another kind of type of horticulture, right? Like, you know, it takes like another extra step that you're trying to like mimic the conditions in which those wild populations would be undergoing as the seeds are growing. But yeah, Barbara has a lot of, you know, a lot of like years of experience doing this. And I know with the Ecotype Project, like I mentioned in Connecticut, they've had a lot of success in planting these native species. There's also the Wild Seed Project in Maine, which again is, you know, their focus is wild seeds, growing these wild native seeds and propagating them. So, you know, it's tricky, but it can be done.
Yeah. I have more questions for you, but we first need to take a sponsor break. We'll be right back.
Took all the trees and put them in a tree museum, and charged the people a dollar and a half to see them.
Your number one buying destination,
Central Auto Group.
When is a car not a car? When it turns into a driveway. And that's what we're doing here at Central Auto Group, home of Ford, Mazda, Hyundai, Volkswagen, and pre-owned in the month of March. Putting dreams in driveways. Ford F-150s, Mazda CX-30s, Hyundai Tucson's, Volkswagen Tiguan's, just to name a few. Central has them all. Central has more cars in stock for immediate delivery. Drive a little and save a lot. If you want to sell your car, Central will pay you cash. Regardless of your credit, Central Auto Group works the hardest to get you approved. Shop 24/7 at CentralAutoGroupCG.com. Exit 28 off I-395 in Plainfield.
Your number one buying destination. destination. Central Auto Group.
When you hear commercials for insurance, you generally hear something like 10 minutes could save you $100. My name is Dave Woodmansey from Woodmansey Insurance, and I would like you to know that the same $100 you saved in 10 minutes today could cost you thousands of dollars down the road. If your present insurance company did not take the time to properly gather your information and design an insurance package tailored to fit your needs, you may experience severe shortages or gaps in your coverage in the unfortunate event of a loss. And many of you have never had an insurance loss before and don't know what to expect. As a Woodmansey Insurance customer, you can take comfort in the fact that we understand what you are going through and will be there to guide you through the claim process. Our knowledgeable staff will answer your questions, provide advice, and fight for your rights when it comes time for your claim to be settled. For a review of your current coverage needs for your home, auto, business, or life insurance, you can stop in and see us at Woodmansey Insurance. We are located at 1122 Main Street in Wyoming, 539-7000.
The wait is over at Girard Nissan. We are celebrating with a new state-of-the-art facility with a new drive-through service and an extra allocation of hundreds of new Nissans. Hi, this is Crystal from Girard Nissan, and we are so excited that there is no waiting for a brand new Nissan. Pick out your dream ride and put it in your garage today. Choose from award-winning new Nissan Rogues, Frontiers, Pathfinders, Sentras, Altimas, all in stock. Have you been hit with hard times? We get it, and we're here to help. Get pre-approved in minutes. Just call 860-448-0050 and ask for me, Crystal. Girard Nissan supports the troops and has special incentives for veterans all month long. Yes, for all branches of the military. Girard Nissan, Route 184 Groton, the submarine capital of the world, and at GirardNissan.com, serving you for 60 great years.
So you could be wherever you wanted to be.
Mystic Luxury Cinema. Enjoy movies the way they were meant to be seen, on the big screen.
It is so big.
Heated seats and 7.1 Dolby surround sound. Big movies, big sound.
There's a big, big sound.
Mystic Luxury Cinema and All South County Cinema, where movies are movies and a night out is fun.
And we look good.
Oh boy, popcorn and candy bars and ice cream and sparkling ice cold
wine and beer.
Mystic Luxury Cinema and Old Mystic Village in All South County Cinemas in South Kingston.
More great savings this week at McQuaid's. McQuaid's own Irish soda bread, only $4.99 each. 8-ounce Kerrygold butter, only $2.99. Boar's Head honey ham, only $7.99 a pound. Linda Lake's American cheese, only $5.99 a pound. 24 packs of Poland Spring water, two for $9. 6-pack of Thomas's English muffins, buy one, get one free. Now that's quality without compromise. McQuaid's Marketplace, Main Street in Westerly, and Clara Drive in Mystic.
WBLQ Local Weather.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mark Resenthal with you on this Thursday. Here's what's happening. Sun, a few clouds, breezy, nice, temps at least 50. And then overnight, we're talking clear, cool weather, near freezing. Tomorrow, morning sun, the clouding up, maybe some afternoon showers, low and mid-50s. Saturday, sun, clouds, and becoming breezy during the afternoon, low 50s. Sun, clouds, breezy, colder on Sunday. I'm Mark Resenthal. That's your WBLQ local weather forecast.
We're back with Resiliency Radio, and we have Westerly Land Trust here today, our regular guests, and Shannon Kingsley from the Wild Plant Society, Wild Rhode Island Plant Society. Just to kind of pick up where we left off, I like to sometimes point out to folks that even though you're working with wild plants and we have this idea in our heads that they're carefree and they, you know, in fact, one of the reasons we collect them is because they're self-sustaining populations, et cetera, et cetera. But when we want to transplant them to a non-native environment, we really do have to bring in some of those horticulture practices and skills. You know, it's not just go throw the seeds out somewhere on your yard and expect that you're going to get a thriving native population by doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And Barbara, as I mentioned, Barbara Shaughnessy is our horticulturist for the reseeding Rhode Island project. But she she, along with RIPS volunteers and part of our steering committee for reseeding, worked to plant these seeds, to winter sow them, and so now they're in cold frames, actually on Barbara's property. We do have a couple little seedlings popping up. One is gray goldenrod, and the other is which actually was collected at Grills Preserve, and then also common yarrow. So we have a little bit of success so far, which is always exciting.
Nice, yeah. I mean, collecting the seeds from a native environment, and then bringing them into this man-made environment. We need to try to mimic that natural environment again, right? So I think you mentioned cold framing, winter sowing. I think people are becoming more aware of what these things are. But, you know, that seed that comes off the goldenrod, that goes through a winter sitting in the soil. So if we just bring it inside our house and it's a dry seed and we just leave it on the counter at room temperature, that's really not mimicking the environment that it grew up in. So I know that a lot of these seeds need what's called cold stratification. So they need to go through a period of damp, cool temperatures. You know, some can be below freezing, I think. I need freezing temperatures to help the seed germinate and crack through its shell. I mean, and every species is different, because if you can think about the timing, some plants drop their seeds in the summer and germinate quickly in the fall, and they're established, and then they can make it through the winter and grow again in the spring. But every species is different. So I'm hoping where I see the future of your program going, and how the Land Trust can continue to support the Land Trust and other conservation organizations, would be, okay, can we help propagation? I think that would be really cool. So we don't have to rely on just these few nurseries that are invested in native plant propagation, that everybody can. If we had a westerly ecotypic seed bank, that would be amazing. That hyper-local diversity, I think, would be great.
Yeah, and right now, so I guess I didn't mention this, but part of what we're working on right now for the project is finding places where we can have these what we call founder plots, where these are places where we can grow. We're looking at like about 3 species per founder plot, but these are places that will take care of these plants, and then once they are ready to set their seed, that seed would be then collected, and then that seed would be able to be used for restoration, for homeowners, for, you know, like I said, for the native plant sales, for RIPS. And so right now we are looking to potentially work with like Land Trust, such as Westerly Land Trust, or organizations kind of like you guys, to have these founder plots.
You could potentially have a founder plot at a farm too, right? A mixed-use farm. So we have a lot of farming clients at the conservation district. So yeah, that'd be something we could present to them as an option.
And they already have all the infrastructure, good soils, you know, water.
Potentially, depends on what kind of farm.
Right.
Yeah.
This is true.
Yeah. And we are working with a few farms right now, but we're just trying to, like, you know, increase that list of organizations and farms involved to host these founder plots. Because right now, so last season I collected 30 species, and we seeded 19 of those, like winter sowed those 19 species. So once those 19 species have grown up a little bit, those will be then planted at these founder plots. So, yeah.
Is there any funding to help support the establishment of the founder plots?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. I know the funding for reseeding Rhode Island mostly comes from support of RIPS. So, you know, membership and the native plant sales make up a lot of the funding for projects like reseeding Rhode Island and make it possible for RIPS to do those sorts of initiatives. But yeah, I'm not sure exactly about the founder plot. Funding.
I've wanted to join RIPS on some of the botanizing walks they have. It seems like it's really cool, you know, really interesting opportunity. I'm sure amateurs and experts alike would learn something new. And they have those monthly, maybe, or I want to say they have a great newsletter. Erica can speak to this as somebody who's in the newsletter game. It's very competitive. It's very competitive realm communications, you know, and Rhode Island Wild Plant Society is one that I probably just because I'm interested, but I think they put out a great newsletter, and it seems that there's always some cool walk or event going on. Yeah. Erica, what does the Land Trust have coming up? Well, I would like to do some botanizing walks, but I need to practice. So if we have any experts out there, reach out. Anyone who would like to lead some walks.
Skunk cabbage is already coming up.
Yes, I know,
saw
right?
It on my backyard the other day. Yeah. It's one of my favorites.
When you think about it as a flower, I mean, it's incredible, and it generates its own heat. I mean, this
well,
is
I can
incredible.
Come up now.
Yeah.
So we are back in the swing of living laboratories at the Westerly Land Trust. So that is for Westerly Public Schools, K through fourth graders, where they can come out to our properties and learn from Westerly Land Trust educators about a variety of topics. It's really cool, hands-on, after school. Bus transportation is provided. It's free of charge for the students. So all of these things you can find out more about on our website. We have some hikes coming up. There's always a Thursday hike going on. We've got one this morning, in fact. And those are geared for people who want to get out and explore different trails, not only Westerly Land Trust trails, but trails all over our area. So those are really, really fun as well. We have the Lucky Leprechaun hike tomorrow night.
Whoa.
At St. Riverwood. Patrick's Day. Yep. And Shannon's already wearing her green today, so I don't know. I mean, I feel like Land Trust is always wearing green, right?
Mm-hmm.
So no pinches. Green. Yeah, we're all green. No pinches
embodied.
For anybody tomorrow. But I think that one actually, that hike might be full. So check it out on the website. But I think that one has reached capacity. We do have a yoga hike coming up on the spring equinox, which is Monday, if you guys can believe that we
wow.
are through the winter already. It doesn't feel like winter even started.
I know.
In a way here. But we're making our way into spring, and then, you know, summer will be right upon us. And one thing that I'm really excited about is that for the fourth consecutive year, the Westerly Land Trust is participating in 401 Gives, which is Rhode Island's Day of Giving, sponsored by the United Way of Rhode Island. And it's a day in which everybody, you know, you log into your computer, you look for the Rhode Island philanthropies that speak the most to you, that you know, you value the most, and you make your contribution to them. So check out Westerly Land Trust on that day. And there are lots of other Westerly nonprofits participating as well. I encourage everybody to take a look at the list and see, you know, you've probably got some friends participating. One really cool thing about 401 Gives this year is that because April 1st, which is 401 Gives for our area code, falls on a Saturday, it's a whole weekend edition starting at 6 a.m. on Friday. So going all the way through Monday at 6 p.m. So it's 4 days of giving. Yes.
401, 2, 3, and 4.
Well, and 3:31.
Nice.
We got to start at 3:31.
Okay,
yes,
nice.
Exactly. I did actually go out and look up all of the area codes because I thought that would be fun, like 3:31. And I'm not going to bore you with all that information right now. But I know that one of them is Canada. So.
And she bored us with that information.
I did. I've already bored you. But I do want to back up real quick because I was not ready earlier when we were talking about the composting toilet, and now I am ready. I needed a running start, and I just wanted to make sure that credit is given where it is deserved to the Southern New England Educational and Charitable Foundation, SNCC, our good friends Sharon Girls Jackson and Steve Jackson.
Thank you. Yeah, they're great.
We love them. I know. They help out a lot with our education programs, which, as I said, as we kicked off what I was talking about, Living Laboratories is a huge amount to them, and of course to the Southern Rhode Island Conservation District as well. So
yeah. The kids were yesterday was the start of the programming, and the kids were learning about the program this week is called Nifty Navigators, and they were learning how to use a compass and how to navigate to waypoints, and I thought that was really great. I would have loved something like that, you know. I can use a compass now, but, you know, those are skills that you need to constantly refine.
Right.
Yeah.
I cannot use a compass. No. I should take one of those classes. I should get out there.
You know, a great game that we play sometimes that I play with myself and lately play with other people too is when you're out in the woods taking a walk, stop and think about which way is north. It's a great, great game to play, and I think it's awesome to tune in your internal compass. I think we all have one, believe it or not. I think we get a little out of tune with it, and we have these amazing tools in our pocket in our phones that have compasses, and it takes 1 second to pull it up. And if the more and more you start.
Your smartphone probably has a compass too,
oh,
TJ.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I think these are really great things to start to think about, because having orient, like even right now, okay, this is a radio show, but we can play which way is north right now. Oh, well, and DJ Gadget gave it away.
What?
But for all you.
Oh, and that was before you even turned on your compass. Wow.
So, I mean, no, I can't confirm that. I just because I came up with the game doesn't mean I get it right all the time. But listeners at home, maybe do this right now. I won't do a pause, but it's a great game. And I think you'll really, it's exciting to think about that. So,
I was having a conversation with a friend yesterday that we were talking about, like, do we really need to know how to do math if our phones can do it for us? And now, especially with AI, do we need to know how to write if our phones and our computers can do it for us and all this stuff? And
there's always been calculators, and before that, math machines that or math, the little things. So no, you don't need math.
We cannot even go down the ChatGPT rabbit hole.
I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but all I'm saying is that my argument was that I think it is very important. I think it teaches you other skills, and learning where north is one of those things that, yes, you can rely on instruments, but I think that you can also get in touch with yourself.
Yeah. And I think it'll lead you to discover other wonders, other curiosities, and a life pursuing curiosities is one worth living, I think. So put that on your refrigerator.
By Mark Doherty.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I know we only have a few minutes left, but I'd like to just go back to our topic for just a minute and say I always feel remiss if I don't put this plug in, and I know it's like I'm not going to open the full can of worms here, but just dip the toe in.
Do it.
We love to support wild plants. We know their value. We know their importance. We know their evolutionary significance. But I also just like to point out that the opposite of that is not true. We cannot say that all, you know, horticulturally grown and propagated plants are bad. So, you know, some horticultural plants and breeds have, you know, just as much significance, potential significance for the pollinators, mm-hmm. for local habitat, for local wildlife. So I just like to set that up, that it's not like, you know, native good, everything else bad. It's really a deeper question than that, and you really got to look into a lot of it more. Definitely important to support native, but there are other things that can be supported and can be integrated. And that was why my question earlier on transplanting to non-native habitats, because most of the habitats we're working with most of the time are non-native habitats in some form or other. And so we have to learn to integrate, mm-hmm. you know, between the wild populations and the more horticultural or managed populations. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to throw that out. I got to put my plug in for all the plants, not just the ones that we call native.
I love that. Because I think there's a sort of a wilderness ideal that we still live in. There's also, like, I was just thinking about the other day, this agrarian ideal, this idea that rural America is, we have this nostalgia for it. We have this longing to go back and live in that world. I think the same thing happens with the idea of wild. You know, we have this longing to go back where things were, quote, untouched. But I think that's what it is. It's an ideal, and I don't. It's a place to shoot for. It's the words that we use, but the reality is that we live in I wouldn't say a manicured environment, but an already altered environment. So I think that's why RIPS is we're reintegrating the beauty of horticulture. We as humans are able to work with plants and work with our environment and create more than maybe what was there in the first place or what would be there if we weren't to do anything than a hands-off approach. So the integration of this wild into these man-made systems into horticulture, I think, is great and exemplary of what we need to do.
And let's remember, indigenous tribes and peoples were not hands-off with their plants and their environments. There was a very tight relationship there, and it may not look the same as our relationships with our environments do today, mm-hmm. But there was a relationship there, you know?
that land needed to provide, you know? So and, if you came
and,
across...
And they cared for it in a kind of a way, you know? So it was not a hands-off approach.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So there will always be that integration happening. I just feel like, you know, in modern times, it's kind of got escalated to a different level. But it's the same dance.
Yeah. Love that. Love it. This is great. Okay, what...
Any parting words from Rhode Island Wild Plant Society? Anything else you would like us to know about?
Yeah, I guess like just to your guys' point about the integration, like I think that's why RIPS is such a cool organization because, you know, they cater to the, you know, the people who are interested in just having like a little backyard garden or a few pots on their front porch or something like that. But then taking that a step further with, you know, well, what kind of plants are going to attract the most pollinators, like probably native plants. And so like, you know, getting, you know, just like, you know, the average homeowner to just be a little bit more invested in and question that, like, well, what am I, you know, like what plant am I growing at home? Am I attracting native pollinators? You know, how much fertilizer am I using? Like just kind of like probing those questions. And then with Reseeding Rhode Island, we're trying to take that just like just the next step further with like, okay, well, you know, we're interested in native plants, but we're also interested in ecotypic plants. So like we're looking at like, you know, local populations. So
ecotypic is that next nest underneath like a regional native plant. Yeah, it's native to New England, but like, right. So let's look at native to even here. Maybe a great thing. A challenge for everybody would be maybe find a local native plant of interest to you and grow it this year and see how it goes. You know, I
like that challenge.
Yeah, yeah. So find one out there. Whether and you know, you can go to the Rhode Island Wild Plant Society website to get some inspiration and maybe find local suppliers. I'm trying to think. A great native seed.
Yeah, do you have a favorite, Mark? Do you have a favorite native plant?
Oh, that I'm well. So this year I'm taking my first shot at propagating some spice bush. So that's an understory tree that does well in the sun too. Okay, so an example like forsythia, a non-native plant, but beautiful, does provide early season pollen for some plants. Okay, we can talk about the nutritional value of that pollen, but it provides beauty for us too. But we can also integrate a native early springtime blooming plant like northern spice bush. The seeds are edible, the fruit is edible, the leaves have a beautiful aroma when they're crushed. They're very soft and gentle. They turn a beautiful yellow in the fall. So anywho, I have some of those seeds that I left in my refrigerator cold stratifying over the winter. They got a little bit moldy. I left the fruit on, but the mold was just in the fruit and the seed seems good to me. So I'm just trying it. And don't be afraid to fail. I think you gardening, there's, and especially the wealth of information we have nowadays, it can be, you know, everyone has an opinion on how to do it. And it can be really overwhelming and that can paralyze you. So don't be afraid. Give it a shot. And if you don't succeed this year, you'll probably do a lot better next year. So that's my go around this season, Spice Bush.
All right. And we are at our time. So if you want to pursue any of these things, you can contact Rhode Island Wild Plant Society. You can contact Westerly Land Trust. And you can contact Southern Rhode Island Conservation District.
And I just want to plug the actual dates now that I have them for the RIPS plant sale. It's May 13th at Casey Farm in Saunderstown. That begins at 9 a.m. June 3rd at URI in Kingston. That begins at 9 a.m. And then also there's one on Saturday, August 26th at Patuxent Farmers Market. So
we'll see you there.
Thank you. Resiliency Radio Hour. We'll be back next week.
No, no, no. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone. You leave paradise and put up a pumpkin.